marketing gets it wrong when they forget about the humanity of the person who needs to make a decision. And product gets it wrong when they forget about the humanity of the person who's going to be using the product. So I use the word empathy. I think empathy is at the core of product and of marketing. What you want to do is understand your buyer or your user as a human who has a job to be done, who's trying to make progress in their own life or career, and then meet them where they are. And that it starts with marketing, and then it gets delivered on with product. If we can center the user in all of that journey, we're going to do way better. If we leave the user behind and we just start going like salesperson to procurement, you know, that's a horribly fragile way to operate.
Hi, welcome to Path to Growth. I'm Tracy Young, co-founder and CEO of TigerEye. Today, we are joined by Dave Boyce, Executive Chairman and EVP of Product at Winning by Design. Dave, welcome.
Thank you so much, Tracy. It's going to be a good conversation.
Yeah, to start, can you tell me about what you learned from your mom and dad?
You're going right for it, huh? Yeah, I'm the oldest of eight kids, Tracy, and I grew up in Oklahoma, and I wore hand-me-down clothes. From whom, you may ask? From people who felt sorry for us. My mom and dad worked hard. My mom did not work outside the home. My dad, you know, made always less than $50,000, and they owned their home, and all the kids, you know, got college educations, and they really invested in us. I learned about love and hard work, but we had to work hard because we all had to kind of like earn our ways forward.
Yeah. My parents were refugees of the Vietnam War, and they came here with nothing, with no family. And so wherever the line was between poverty and just being homeless, they were always like, not always, they worked themselves into the middle class eventually, but for many, many years,
wow,
just right above that line.
Whoa, so what a story.
Hand-me-down clothes. I think that's totally fine. The kids grow out of it so fast anyways.
Totally.
And certainly getting to see how hard they work so that their kids could have a better life than they did was, you know, really inspiring for me and has made me who I am today. And it sounds like for you too.
Yeah, I'm a big fan though. Like anyone who's courageous enough to pick their family up, move from one country to a country that they've never visited and then start over. Wow. What a, like amazing. Hats off to your parents.
That's another topic, but people, you know, people do that when they have no choice, you know. For my parents, they were prepared to like die on a boat into the ocean, then stay in a country that they didn't feel safe in with their daughter, my older sister. Thanks for sharing that with me.
Yeah.
So tell us about Winning by Design and your role there.
Yeah. So as you said, I'm executive chair, but you know, the executive part is my operating role with product. And Winning by Design is, as you probably know, it's a global growth advisory firm. We aspire to step into the void that was left when Serious Decisions was acquired by Forrester. I had a hand in that. I was on the board of Forrester when we bought Serious. But, you know, that pulled Sirius up into kind of an enterprise space and kind of the scale-ups of the world, the $50 to $500 million kind of companies, and a little bit, and even a little bit smaller than that. We're like, wait, where did Sirius go? And so growth advisory is our thing. We have frameworks and research and methodologies that really help you lean into growth in a way that's architected, not just happenstance. And because money is not free anymore, we can't just throw money at the problem. We have to architect our success. And that's what Winning by Design, you know, tries to help customers with.
And it's so important, especially as companies scale, to have those architectures in place, whether it's sales processes or even communication. I feel like we have like a whole architecture of how communication runs down the food chain so that everyone knows what we're doing as a company.
Oh my goodness. Communication. And now with structured and unstructured data and the advent of AI, communication can actually translate. We call it the bow tie, like the customer journey, but can translate across the bow tie in using unstructured inputs, but translating in a structured way so that those handoffs are all codified. That's a huge opportunity, I think, going forward. And you're right. It's about communication and handoffs.
Mm-hmm. So tell me more about the bow tie method. This is something that helps with the whole sales funnel end to end, but explain it to me like I'm 5 years old, because I'm actually not sure I'm super familiar with it.
Can we go like 20 years old? We got to start with the sales and marketing funnel. I don't know what a five-year-old knows about that, but you know, sales and marketing funnel, traditionally it's wide at the top. And then, you know, I qualify out and filter out down to the kind of people who are qualified to and ready to buy based on desired impact. Got it. Cool. Traditional businesses that stop there. But in a recurring revenue business, it doesn't stop there. It almost starts there. So we tip that on its side and turn it into a bow tie. So that kind of the knot of the bow tie is my initial kind of commitment between the customer and the company selling the product or service. And then from there, I need to kind of onboard, deliver impact, retain based on that impact, and maybe expand my footprint based on that successful impact. And then it ends up looking like a bow tie. And if we're doing it correctly, I start opening up again, at least in terms of recurring revenue, meaning, you know, I got a north of 100% net revenue retention. So it's getting wider. So it gets narrower on the way in, and then it gets wider on the way out as we succeed together.
Right. Just like the shape of a bow tie.
Just like the shape of a bow tie. Yeah.
Walking me through that. You've been part of several acquisitions. What's the patterns that you've seen? Like, what makes an acquisition successful versus the ones that aren't?
That's a big question. It's very difficult to make an acquisition successful, like full stop. Like, I'm sure that more than 50% of acquisitions fail. I bet it's more like 70%. And you'll see companies that got bought, you know, and then got spun out for half of the initial, you know, purchase price. And that's just because they couldn't get those operations to kind of to work together. I've seen two successful models on the other side of acquisition integration. One, Oracle bought a company of mine called ProfitLogic, and they were not shy at all. We were going to run the Oracle playbook, period. Like within a week, we were going to have Oracle systems in place. You know, our emails were gone. The domain was gone. The calendar was gone. Within a month, we were going to have rebranded. Within 6 months, we were going to have kind of gotten all on all of their kind of go-to-market quota systems and measurement, you know, and we're basically reporting back in QBRs pretty much within 6 months. That succeeded. It didn't feel good to me because, you know, we had built all these special things, but it succeeded. Like, you're either going to operate well within the Oracle. And I had one other company bought by a company that did the same thing, and, you know, it worked great. The other thing is to leave an acquired company relatively independent. Independent, yeah. Full stop, not relatively independent. Like, you know, LinkedIn was bought by Microsoft, and it's a complete reporting structure into an independent CEO, independent P&L, independent operating systems. They're just running the same way they were run before. And when I have spoken with Microsoft executives, including Satya, they don't have any intention of integrating that. They're just going to run it independently. They don't even share data across those two. I'm sure they share learnings, but they don't share data or processes or anything that works too. Everything in between is a disaster. Like, you kind of half integrate, but you don't have the courage to go all the way. You keep people around who want to run the old playbook while you have people who want to run the new playbook. That doesn't work.
Yeah. I got the privilege to get acquired into Autodesk with my last startup, and we were relatively independent.
Which meant
that it was just not working out. And I was supposed to run that company, our startup, kind of independent for a full year. And by Q1, it was very obvious things just weren't working out. So we pushed for full integration by five, and it was just much better. We just ripped the bandage off. It's like, we are integrating in the mothership right now. And, you know, it starts with systems, as you say, you know, because we can't be on two calendaring systems, and we have to go to schedule meetings to talk about integration. And, you know, it's not connected to the conference rooms. And I remember the immune system reaction of the team. Like, why are you making us go on to Autodesk's shitty tools? It's like, because you're part of Autodesk now.
Yeah, we use Zoom. We don't use Teams. We use Bamboo HR. We don't use PeopleSoft. Like, it doesn't matter. Yes, you do. You do now.
Yeah. You've led startups, scale-ups, and public companies. What are the patterns that you see across successful growth journeys? What's most important at all of these stages of companies?
you know, we said the word before and you picked it up. And I think we're singing off the same song sheet here, but kind of deliberate growth architecture, Tracy. We call it revenue architecture. It's growth architecture. It's like, and it's as applicable to a startup. You're working on different things in a startup. In a startup, you're working on, you know, deliberately pursuing product market fit, and then in a scale, and then go to market fit. In a scale up, you're really working on repeatable processes and unit economics, and you're just trying to get kind of that steep part of the growth curve working. And then in an enterprise, you know, you're really working on things like sustainability, long-term profitability, and optimization. But in all cases, you don't want to take any of that for granted. You want to architect it specifically. You want to know what you're going for. And I'm a big fan of a general manager or a CEO who knows what she's looking for. She knows what she's solving for, and who is very deliberate about how to go after it. I am not a big fan of the empty suit leader who can't roll her sleeves up and doesn't have the patience to understand how growth is being built. But as soon as you find someone, you know that person, you know these people, like when you meet that person, as soon as you find someone who thinks kind of is a systems thinker about building this machine, you're like, ooh, I'll bet on that person. That'll work.
Mm-hmm. You've held both product and marketing leadership roles. How are they different? Let's start with that.
I'll tell you how both get it wrong. Marketing gets it wrong when they forget about the humanity of the person who needs to make a decision. And product gets it wrong when they forget about the humanity of the person who's going to be using the product. So I use the word empathy. I think empathy is at the core of product and of marketing. And, you know, when we lose that, and I'll throw Oracle under the bus, because I really think, you know, I praise them for their acquisition integration. Now I'm going to ding them for the way that they marketed, at least back then. Their marketing was all, and I hated it because I was running marketing at the time. Oracle's number one in FinServe. Oracle's number one in retail. Oracle's number one in database. Oracle's number one in growth rate for CRM. Like, I don't, that's has nothing to do with your buyer. And then when you put features up front, also has nothing to do with your buyer. What you want to do is understand your buyer or your user as a human who has a job to be done, who's trying to make progress in their own life or career, and then meet them where they are. And that it starts with marketing, and then it gets delivered on with product. If we can center the user in all of that journey, we're going to do way better. If we leave the user behind and we just start going like salesperson to procurement, you know, that's it's a horribly fragile way to operate. And sometimes one team will have empathy and the other team won't. Like, I'm going to market with real empathy, but I'm going to deliver a hard to deploy product, or I'm going to market, we're number one, but deliver actually a really good product that delivers value. I kind of want to get on the same level in terms of user empathy.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's 2025. We're not going to get through this interview without talking about AI. What's your take on it?
Just last week, Winning by Design did an AI GTM conference in San Francisco. We spent months getting ready for this, trying to separate the hype from the reality. Like, let's go find, everyone knows what the art of the possible is because we all read and we all get bombarded, you know, but what's actually happening on the ground right now? Like, where are examples in GTM of where AI is either augmenting or replacing humans and succeeding? Because there's a lot of trials out there with mixed results. So let's go find the ones that are working. We sourced 30 examples that are working. We highlighted from stage some kind of real live demos, like, here's an agent making a phone call, having a conversation with somebody over like a telephone line. Here's an agent that's representing as an animated avatar and doing inbound lead qualification and even selling. One of the awards that we gave away was to HubSpot, who actually has an agent picking product acquired customers off of the kind of PLG happy path and then helping them convert to paid with like human assistant, but it's not human assistance, it's an agent. We saw some really cool examples of that. So I would say what's not going to work, what's not working and what's not going to work is some sort of wholesale whitewash of like, you know, I'm going to, you know, never hire another human. Like, we're only going to only hire robots from now on. Like, that's not going to work. What's also not working is I'm going to buy a technology and that's going to solve my problem. Also not going to work. I sat 2 days ago, I sat next to a CEO who said it really clearly. He's like, you can't assume that you're going to put an agent on your human team and that agent is just going to start succeeding. You actually have to onboard that agent. You have to train that agent. You have to manage and coach that agent to operate in a hybrid team alongside humans, whether it's helping the human succeed at her job or doing the same job as a human shoulder to shoulder. In either case, they need to be onboarded like a human, the AI does. And so being really specific about defining the job, setting up the framework within which the AI is going to operate, setting up the measurement so that you can calibrate and tune and kind of train and manage and coach going forward is what we see working. These broad swaths are not really working.
Yeah. And from our perspective, and we get to talk to so many people, a lot of analysts and folks in go-to-market sales, marketing, and finance, there is a lot of fear, especially in the middle layer. You know, there might be a recession coming. Their headlines are talking about big companies having, you know, layoffs. And people have bills to pay. People have children to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your advice for the workers who are afraid of their jobs? And specifically for this group, it's, you know, their white collar go-to-market jobs.
Yeah. It's kind of like a calculator moment. I've heard AI referred to as a calculator moment. Like, okay, here's life before we had a calculator. I'm penciling everything out. I'm doing long division. Here's life after a calculator. I can just punch it in. So I can either resist the calculator or I can embrace the calculator. You know, did we forget math on the other side of the calculator? Some people might have, but mostly we just learned to do higher order math and operate more quickly and incorporate the calculator into our workflows. And that's my advice to young professionals is like, especially, you know, the more curious and flexible you are and the more you can embrace and the more digitally native you are, just become AI native, you know? Like, I'll tell you, the people I'm hiring are AI native. Like, I want you to be AI native. It has nothing to do with how old you are. It has to do with how curious and flexible you are and whether you've embraced or shunned AI. But you come as an AI capable human in the GTM world, you're worth way more to a GTM operation than the person who's trying to resist it or, you know, out of fear, trying to sort of say AI over there, we humans, you know, better over here. No, it's a reality. We now have calculators. We now have AI. How can it help you do your job better?
Yeah. And that's the message we send out too, which is AI is not going to replace people, but people using AI to supercharge themselves are going to replace people who don't. That's just how it's going to happen. Because for most jobs, especially in go-to-market, I mean, half of your job is talking to people and getting buy-in and like having this tribal knowledge and wisdom and pattern recognition and this like human perspective of like, what are we actually going to do about this? Setting strategy and then actual execution, which is really, really hard. AI can help with some pieces of that, but it's not going to do all of it, not right now, at least, or not in the next 12 months.
No. So I heard, you know, so what used to be called an account executive might in the future be called a deal strategist. That's just an evocative kind of statement. Well, what does that mean? It means all the stuff that you just said. It's the stakeholder management, it's the conversations, it's the nuance. Well, what about all the other stuff? What about the note taking and the forecast management and the CRM updating and the, oh yeah, AI is going to do that for you. So you can do more of what you do uniquely well, and then you rely on AI to take the drudgery.
Yeah. I was at another go-to-market conference. This was in LA a few weeks ago, and I got to give a talk there. And there were some marketers in the room, and they did talk a lot about their fears. They're just like, a lot of my peers are on LinkedIn looking for jobs, and it's been months, and it's just hard because so much has been replaced by even just ChatGPT or any of the models. And from my perspective, there's just a lot more bad marketing right now in the world. What's your take on it? Is it going to get better? Is it going to get worse?
Well, AI is generating a lot of content. AI, it's not quite automatically pushing that content into channels, but it's going to get there. It's building, you know, microsites already. It has the promise of doing kind of mass customized emails, but I haven't really seen that in a way that wasn't stitched together, but it's getting there. It's definitely going to get there. But, you know, who's doing the thinking about who's got the empathy for the end user? Who's checking the AI to make sure that we're meeting the end user where she is? Like, AI is going to get it 80 to 90% right. And then who's actually building out kind of the strategy for that customer journey? AI is going to get that 80 to 90% right. But there's got to be an architect that sits above it, you know, like the marketing strategist. And so my recommendation, if you're on the bench, you got lots of time to go figure these tools out. And most of them you can get your hands on and you can start playing, or you can actually make yourself an expert pretty quickly. Just 2 days ago, I had someone reach out to me and they said they were in between jobs. Could they volunteer on any of our growth initiatives? And I'm like thinking, yeah, I've got like 6 things that you can do right now. And I know this person, I trust them. It's not like I'm just taking a random person off the street, but I guarantee you, as they pursue their kind of job path, 2 months from now, they'll land a great job. And that job will probably be partially as a result of them having really immersed themselves in some AI go-to-market stuff that differentiates themselves from their peers.
Mm-hmm. As an advisor who gets to meet with a lot of people and a lot of teams, especially in the C-suite, what are the red flags that you notice when you're working with new teams?
So the biggest thing, Tracy, is alignment. You know, this has really plagued us, you know, companies. And, you know, we all come about this, honestly, we grow up and we get bigger and we hire leaders and leaders. Every one of our go-to-market leaders has an MBA and go-to-market, but they all got them from, you know, an MBA, quote unquote, but they all got them from different universities, right? Like, I learned mine at Oracle and you learned yours at, who did you start a company to again?
Autodesk,
right. So did we run the same place? Probably not. Is yours right for this current environment? Maybe. Is mine right for this current environment? Maybe. But what we got to do is get aligned. And there are different go-to-market motions that are appropriate in different markets. So if you're used to running a PLG motion and I'm used to running a 2-stage inbound kind of SDR AE motion, which one is right? Let's decide. Let's get aligned. How are we going to measure it? That's the number one thing when I start engaging with the team is we got to get alignment. Everyone's got to understand the game we're playing. If we're playing hockey, great, let's play great hockey. If we're playing football, great, let's play great football. If we're playing basketball, let's play great basketball. But it's not a function of where you came from or what you learned in the past. It's a function of how to design today's business the way that we want to design it. And once we're aligned, then usually things start to happen. Like, usually we know we're measuring in the same way. We're operating in the same way, the same playbook. We've got, to your point about communication, we're communicating and doing handoffs in the same way. We're putting things in systems in the same way. Marketing is no longer declaring victory while sales is declaring failure and CS is declaring like I'm underwater, because we all see it the same way. We're operating against that bow tie. So I think the number one thing is alignment, but it's not easy. Like, it's not easy to drive alignment. You got to have leadership, true capital L leadership, that insists on that and doesn't let those silos keep operating.
Yeah, one of the problems that we see over here at TigerEye is something as simple as key metrics. Everyone's using a different definition of it and a different formula to calculate things. And it's one of the problems that we solve over here at TigerEye, is just getting everyone on the same formula when they talk about win rate and churn and how they're calculating it. MQLs, SQLs. So even when you see teams arguing, it's like, wait, you guys aren't arguing about the same thing. You're using them as different, you know, they're completely different things, even though you're using the same words.
So important. That's kind of where this bow tie data model comes in place, is there's standard definitions for, like you said, an MQL. Great. So now when marketing talks about an MQL, they mean the same thing as when sales talks about an MQL, same thing as when finance talks about an MQL. So we're measuring everything according to the same definition. Now I can run faster, right? Now I don't have to spend half of my meeting deciding whether we're speaking the same language and then the other half working on the problem.
The number of times where I've had sales, marketing, and finance show me either a different dashboard or spreadsheet, you know, just on pipeline or something like that, something on the funnel. And it's like, wait, why are the numbers different?
I can only imagine.
Theirs is the right one.
That's got to be super frustrating for you. Like, you're like, we're trying to make decisions to get the company forward, not decisions about who's right.
Yeah. It's so toxic and just ineffective. And I feel like most companies are plagued with this.
Sure. I think most, for sure. Definitely more than half.
Mm-hmm. And probably. Then just a lack of leadership and bad systems. I think the leadership is the hard part.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your long-term goals for Winning by Design?
You know, our aspirational goal is to make go-to-market interoperable. That sounds really weird, but, you know, we don't think you should have pay a translation tax internally. We're talking about the internal silos between marketing, sales, customer success, finance, got it. But what about when I bring on a CRM versus a conversational intelligence platform, or I hire a marketing agency versus a sales methodology coach? Shouldn't that all kind of reconcile to a same view of the world? What if MQL meant the same thing across all of those? And what if, like, the handoff, we use a SPICED methodology: situation, pain, impact, critical event, and decision. And we use that to do handoffs across the bow tie. And we have certified partners now who have SPICED built in. So Fathom, Grain, Momentum, Sybil, Gong, these are all using SPICED as the way to capture notes in an unstructured way, put it into a structured thing that can then feed downstream systems, other certified partners of ours that are measuring and monitoring pipeline. So SPICED is a really simple example. Bowtie is a really simple example. We don't have a big kind of conquer the world objective or even a big monetary objective. We have an objective to just speed up innovation by making those things interoperable.
That's really admirable. Trust in leaders can be made or broken when things get tough. How do you deal with a crisis?
So I've learned this over time, learned it the hard way. Like I was running a startup in Silicon Valley where it was really tough. Like I was on like my 20th and then my 25th and then my 30th fundraising pitch. And we were running out of money. Like we had revenue, but not enough. We had a team that the revenue wouldn't support. And I had to raise the next round of funding. And everybody knew it. Everybody knew, like, you know, they were rooting for me, but, you know, when I came back after the 25th and still didn't have any money, you know, people start to lose confidence and faith. And I was tempted, Tracy, to stay out of the office. Like, he's fundraising, he's out of the office. Like, you know, it's, and it would be perfectly excusable, right? Because that's what I was supposed to be doing. But what I learned is you have to be there. Like, when there's a crisis, you have to show up. You have to be in the pain with the people working on the problem. They got to see you working on the problem. You got to have sleeves rolled up. You cannot get aloof and you cannot get absent. Yeah. You got to get more present in a crisis. And actually what you learn is that all humans want to solve problems. Like, not all humans. Once in a while you get someone who bounces and then you've learned something about them. Like when the going gets tough, she leaves. Like, that's not cool. But most humans, when the going gets tough, as long as they have a leader that they trust, because that leader is in working on it, you know, they'll roll up sleeves and they'll work on it with you. And that particular story had a happy ending, but I had to get to 40 VC pitches to bring home the round that then gave us new life. But I could have lost the team at 20 or 25 or 30 if I gave into my worst instincts to kind of duck and cover and yeah. stay away.
Yeah. And for those listening, it's, you just have to get one. You just have to get one investor to say yes and write you that check, you know, as long as it's big enough. And in the meantime, it is really, really hard to put your hard work on a platter up for sale. Really, that's what you're doing, is selling a chunk of it and then getting no's and doors slammed in your face over and over and over again. I guess in a lot of ways, it's sales, right? That's what sales is all about. You just keep going. I totally agree with you. It's like when it's wartime, you want to see the leader there with the troops. Dave, it's been so fun talking to you. I could go on for another hour, but we're nearing the end. So I'm going to give you a couple rapid fires.
Perfect. Let's do it.
Your favorite book on business. What's your recommendation?
My recommendation is a book by Clayton Christensen called Competing Against Luck. I think it really gets to the core of this empathy and job to be done problem and really helps you think about customers and innovation.
Forecasting, is it art or science?
Oh man, that's like bait without a hook. It is more science than art. It really is. Like, and especially now that we can capture unstructured data with AI, we can hear the words of the customer rather than relying on a CSM or a rep to do the art piece of interpretation. I like it as science.
The best advice you've ever got on managing a sales team?
I think the best advice I ever got on managing a sales team is assume good intent. Nobody shows up wanting to fail. Nobody shows up wanting to do a bad job. So it's assume good intent and invest in the people.
Tell us about one person who's helped you become the leader you are today.
Well, this is cheating a little, maybe. I had the good fortune of knowing Clayton Christensen before he passed away and considering him a friend. And I think he is the systems thinker that I admire the most, but not only for his brain, but he's also extremely empathetic. He treats everyone like a human and makes time for you. And I aspire to be that person.
I'm really glad that you guys got to cross paths during this lifetime.
Yeah. Really good dude. I think about him all the time.
Yeah. I'm sorry he's not here with you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Very, very heartbreaking to not be able to talk to someone you respect that much.
Agreed.
Let's end on a good note.
Let's do that.
Some parting advice. What's one parting advice you'd give to our listeners who are might be early on in their career or just, you know, newly in their executive roles?
Parting advice, it's about fit. Life is about fit. Like, you are the world's best at something. And figuring out what that is will allow you to step into an arena that will allow you to do your very best work. Doing your best work is one of the components that makes you happy. Like, are you making contributions? And happiness has gravity. And gravity attracts all the other things. So pursue fit first, which produces happiness, which then attracts salary, opportunity, partners, employees, jobs. Don't pursue salary, opportunities, partners, jobs, you know, on their own. It goes the other direction. You can get the job and get the salary and still not be happy and then not do your best work. And that's a downward spiral. So just flip it. Pursue fit and happiness first, and all the other stuff will come.
Yeah, I love that. Chase fit and curiosity, like what turns you on in a way, right? Versus
exactly.
Prestige or money or the other stuff.
Exactly.
With that, thank you, Dave. It was a great conversation.
Thank you so much, Tracy. This has been fun.